Welcome to Our Voices, Our Future, the podcast where we amplify the voices driving change and equity within medicine and beyond. Brought to you by the Gender Equity Task Force, a committee of the American Medical Women's Association, we're here to challenge norms, break barriers, and ignite conversations that matter. I'm Megan Etsy, and in each episode, we'll bring you candid discussions with leaders, changemakers, and advocates working to create a more inclusive and just world. No more silence, no more waiting. It's time to get our voices, our future. Today, we are welcoming Dr. Mai Fong, founder and leader of Institute for Exceptional Care and the national leader in payment policy and healthcare transformation. Thank you for being here with us today.
Thanks so much, Megan. It's a real honor.
So just to start out, can you share a little bit of what inspired you to pursue a career in health policy and how your personal or professional experiences helped shape your understanding of gender equity along the way?
Wow, that's a big question. I would say I'm proud to report that I was one of the world's most reluctant pre-meds. And that was because I am a first generation immigrant. And in a lot of immigrant families, at least back when I was young, you know, your choices were teacher, doctor, lawyer. And I knew that I wanted to help people. And I also knew I didn't have the patience to be a teacher the way my dad was. So I went into medicine, but what I did was I took a gap year back when it wasn't popular yet between college and medical school. And I worked for a public health attorney who was an advocate on Capitol Hill for vaccine development and immunization policy. And she and I also worked on issues related to women and HIV, which in 1990 was a new thing. And so I got exposed to all kinds of wonderful grassroots efforts, but also the International AIDS Conference. And that's when I got smitten. I finally could put a name to that thing that I felt drawn to, which was policy. And I think I've had an interesting career in part because I didn't really have a set path in mind. I was really mostly trying to follow my belly and trying to make change in those areas that, as I like to say, enrage me the most. But that often meant putting myself in rooms where I was nearly always the youngest person, certainly the only woman of color, and oftentimes the only woman physician. And so I've had to grow up in that world. And so now it's actually, why I say it's an honor is because for the first time in my life, there's so many women in this space doing this work now. And I'm glad to have all these new playmates.
Yeah, I think it's kind of cool that you said this before, you were kind of the only woman, especially woman of color in the room, but now you get to have a lot of people around you. You've kind of seen the change of things happening first and foremost, which is super cool. Over the course of your career, what have been some key lessons you've learned about promoting gender equity within policy spaces, especially in those environments that may not have been receptive or inclusive at the start?
Yeah, you know, I think there have certainly been moments in my career when I have done what I thought I needed to do to, quote unquote, get along. But if I'm honest with myself, the moments of breakthrough when I felt like I made the most advances in putting my ideas and making the change I wanted to make out there were actually moments when I was most myself and I was least inhibited. That wasn't always easy for other people to receive, but the reason I say that is because we're all unique. And it's when we try to suppress what is unique about ourselves that we come off as vanilla and not memorable. But when you are authentic, when you are, for example, authentically conveying the panic you feel for poor people and what happens to them in a system where financial incentives are really dangled in all the wrong places, that conveys. That's authentic, and it gives your voice something that is worth listening to. Similarly, when I moved from doing research into government, And I was running programs and creating policy programs and payment structures, but most of the leaders that I worked for didn't understand research. And I had to authentically convey to them what that meant. And you come to learn that the unique combination of what your background comprises and a lot of who I am is my gender. That unique combination is what makes you valuable to others, and especially to others who are counting on you. You know, what you are when you staff a political leader or a policy leader is you're trying to keep them safe. And they feel a lot safer when they feel like they are hearing that, you know, unspoken, lesser known perspective, because it means it's less likely that they will miss some important issue. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. So gender equity and health policy is often influenced by who's at the table making those decisions. What challenges or barriers have you observed, either personally or systemically, that have prevented women or gender diverse professionals from accessing leadership in health policy?
Yeah, it is a matter of finding and building and maintaining the right relationships. I haven't always been the most efficient or effective at that, and I do, you know, I fully grant that I have seen lots of boys clubs. They're good people, they're well-intended, but you gravitate toward people who are familiar to you and who make you feel comfortable. And you know, there are such things as healthcare bros, and you have to decide how much you want to interact in that world. I think for me, the lesson learned was at some point you have to be honest with yourself about what you're willing to do and what you're not. And I've had a few opportunities to think about whether I wanted to be in the C-suite at some rather large healthcare organizations, public and private sector. And there's still a small part of me that says, you know, I wouldn't turn it down if the offer were made. But there's a much bigger part of me that decided quite definitively, you know what? I don't like what people have to do to get there. And I don't like the people who are there when they behave that way. And that was one reason that I found it much more compelling to start my own nonprofit, was to create the leadership, the kind of leadership space that I wanted to be in. So that's a hard lesson learned because, you know, you're young and you're ambitious and you're chasing this wanted kind of role, you know, industry leadership, and you want to be the kind of person who had done these things, had collected these titles and made these decisions. But there is a price to pay if you're not in the right space.
Very fair. So let's shift towards a little bit more one of your areas of advocacy, sexual and reproductive health for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. This is a population that's often overlooked in policy design. How did you first kind of become engaged in this work, and what gaps did you notice when you started?
So this is interesting because when I was a resident, I knew very little about intellectual developmental disabilities, but I was taking a medical ethics course that was required. And for that course, I did some research and wrote a policy piece about sterilization of women with intellectual disability. And I got it published, and it was actually what launched me into my fellowship. And then I didn't think about it again for many years. Then I became a mom, and my second child, Alex, who's now 22, is autistic. And they recently, I would say within the last recent, you know, for two middle-aged persons, like in the last 4 years, they've been on their own trans journey. And that has actually gone beautifully, but it wasn't guaranteed that way. And so learning alongside Alex and learning from Alex what all that meant at the same time that at Institute for Exceptional Care, we were doing projects where we were trying to learn from the disability community what health outcomes are most important to them. And I was not shocked when sexual reproductive gender health and parenting was named as like its own key domain of health outcomes that were important to the community. What did surprise me were all the nuances of the mistrust and the harm and the access challenges and the struggles that people go through every day to feel dignified and respected and served in the ways that they need. Did you know that many adults with IDD or adolescents with IDD are never asked by their clinicians about their sexual health? We shouldn't assume that people don't want to have a sexual life, and we shouldn't assume that people don't want to be parents. There are plenty of people who are neurodiverse or have intellectual disability who are also parents. That is part of, for many people, having a fulfilling life, and that's supposed to be the goal of health and healthcare, is to help people thrive. So there's that issue. We aren't nearly as far away from forced sterilization as we would like to think. And neither are we that far away from, we're not far away at all. Just 2, 3 years ago, we saw a report from Canada that documented 60% higher maternal mortality for women with intellectual disability than for other women. And that is not biology. That's about their interactions with the healthcare system, whether that's prenatal care or communication challenges when they're under stress or their sensory needs that aren't taken care of, lack of explanation, whatever it is, we can do a lot better. And then I also don't know if it's commonly known in the medical community that people with IDD have a much higher prevalence of queer identity than people who are not, and in particular, a much higher prevalence of trans identity. This may have a biological basis. There's some reason to think that. But nevertheless, it's stigma upon stigma upon stigma and challenge upon challenge upon challenge to find that care relationship that is trusting, that would allow people to open up, that would enable them to advocate for themselves and get the services they need. We ended up, Alex and I ended up choosing for their gender care, a free clinic in the city that has served the queer community for decades. They were one of the barrier breakers in the early HIV epidemic. And so it was, to me, not at all a surprise that Alex would feel comfortable there. Wonderful primary care clinician. It could have all gone so, so wrong. And so finding those best practices, helping clinicians build those very, very basic skills and knowledge so that they feel more confident and not so anxious and put off when a quote unquote different patient shows up, is one of the most important things about IEC's work.
So, like you mentioned, there's often harmful misconceptions of people with IDD are asexual or they don't need this reproductive health care. What would you say is the most urgent policy and clinical changes that need to be made to ensure a more inclusive, respectful, and comprehensive care for these individuals?
I think that if you are seeing anyone, any adolescent or young adult, you should be asking them about their sexual life. You should be doing those screenings. You should be opening that door to the deeper conversation about what's important to them, what their goals are, what their fears are, and giving them basic sexual education so that they can take care of themselves, assessing for sexual safety. That's a really big thing for this population. And especially, for people with disabilities who are gendered in a way that exposes them to even more potential harm from sexual partners or from family members or other people in their lives. Those are some really, really basic skills. There's, people don't have to become experts in transgender care. You just have to be expert in humanness and in being consistent in what you offer all your patients. And then, I know this sounds contradictory to be both consistent and tailored in your approach, but you can be consistent in making sure that you're asking and offering, and then tailored in the way that you do it. Tailored in the way that you say, may use plain language and maybe do some physical demonstrations of using contraceptive devices or methods, or in the way that you refer people to peer support groups, and coaching them about how to recognize the signs of potential abuse and giving them resources to reach out for help. These are, I think, things that are easy for clinicians to absorb. It's a matter of convincing yourself that, there's some people who need this more than others.
So you've had a career that fit bridges policy, equity, and care for historically excluded populations. What advice would you want to give students or early career professionals, especially women, who want to lead with equity in health policy or advocacy, who may not know where to start?
Yeah, so I guess I have several bits of advice. One is don't chase a topical area because it seems important. Chase it because it's what enrages you and it's where you want to make change. The second thing I would say is don't underestimate the power of your technical training. Yes, the credential helps for sure. For good and bad, the MD for some reason takes you into more rooms than other degrees might. But it's actually the way that the technical training shapes the wiring in your brain and your ability to systematically analyze situations and factors that drive a particular outcome, whether it's clinical or in the marketplace or at a policy systems level. And that's really worth leaning into. I sort of feel like we should sprinkle epidemiology into the water system. Because I think we'd all be better citizens if we all understood that kind of thinking and that kind of approach to problem solving. I would say reach out for mentors, try different things. There is no one great path. I do think that if you are not sure what platform or venue you want to be in when you do this practice, it's good to find a training program, a postgraduate training program that gives you a community while you're gaining some of these additional skills. That community will launch you in terms of mentorship, but also those are the connections that help you find interesting positions later in ways you can't predict, truly. And then beyond that, it's all about specifics and how to do this while raising a family, if that's what you want to do, or living in a certain place.
Yeah, and I think that comes back to more mentorship, right? It's great to have people who have done that before you kind of give you advice on how to navigate that life with everything.
Yeah.
So thank you so much today for this conversation and all your insight. It's been a great talk.
Thank you, Megan. It's such a great idea, to have this podcast as a steady source of inspiration.
Thank you so much. So that's a wrap on this episode of Our Voices, Our Future. We hope today's conversation inspired you, challenged you, and reminded you the power of raising your voice. The fight for equity doesn't stop here. Join us in the movement. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and if you love this episode, share it with someone who needs to hear it. Until next time, stay bold, stay vocal, and keep the conversation going. But this is Our Voices, Our Future.